When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition comic book podcast, where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, Brian Reese.
That is me. I am Brian Reese.
Yes.
How's Brian, it going today, Paul?
It's good. You're very eager to get this started.
I am. I'm excited. This is a very exciting podcast.
It is. This is the 50th episode.
Yes. Happy anniversary, Paul.
Happy anniversary to you as well. We've done 50 of these bad boys, or we will have done 50.
This is 50. We're good.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
We can say this. This is a thing that we can say.
We don't even have a cake or anything. There should be fireworks and John Philip Sousa music or something.
I know. Like across the width and breadth of this great country of ours.
Absolutely.
From Denver, Colorado to Chicago, Illinois.
Which really isn't that far.
No, it's not. But, you know.
Yeah, but we could spread out further.
We could fly over all of the rest.
That's right.
Oh! Yeah,
the hell with the coasts. Who cares about those things?
Yeah.
But I want to thank our listeners. Those who have been listening to us from the start and new listeners just joining us. It's great to have you here and giving us feedback and encouragement. And it always amazes me that there are actually listeners to this show. Because, you know, these are conversations that we were having anyway.
You know? And now we're just recording them.
Yeah, well, that's how this whole thing started. I mean, to everyone out there, Brian and I would just get on the phone and discuss the same thing we're talking about on the show. We debate a comic or a movie or a book. And I remember thinking, wow, we should just record this and see if anyone comes around to listen. And you did. So I just want to say thank you all for listening. Thank you. We really do appreciate you being here and keeping us going.
Yes. Thank you.
And so on this momentous occasion, we will be discussing Alan Moore's seminal run on Swamp Thing, specifically the arc Murder of Crows that covers issues 43 to 50 and has serial killers, Satanists, ghosts, and hallucinations. What more could you ask for?
What more indeed?
But before we do that, there are things in the world of comics that are happening that we would like to discuss. First of all, New York Comic Con happened. Things were announced. Cause was played. Speakers spoke. And by all accounts, everyone had fun.
Dropped some F-bombs, apparently.
Yeah, so people do that all the time. I don't understand what the big deal is.
The whole cussing and crying and carrying on, I don't know. It's, you know.
Anyway. Stuff happened in New York. I don't really have much more to say about that.
Yeah, I think we're both, like a lot of the announcements were kind of,
Well, they were, we discussed this off mic before we started, was they're mostly just things that have already been announced, more that in solicitations and whatnot.
Right. So, or if they weren't announced, they weren't surprises.
Exactly.
Like, oh, hey, there's going to be a new Star Wars comic. Well, that's shocking.
Yes, exactly.
Didn't see that coming from a mile away.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, New York's interesting in the fact that, you know, traditionally it's more comic book based than how San Diego is more movie and TV based.
Right.
So you do get more comic book stuff, but I was kind of disappointed that we didn't get, you know, real big groundbreaking, earth shattering things.
I don't know if we can anymore. I don't know how much out there is really earth shattering anymore. And what's the last earth-shattering thing that happened in comics? You know, Bendis leaving Marvel for DC?
That was it. I think that was the last big thing.
That is a big deal to 500 of us. It's like when a writer who has been so exclusively one thing moves to another. So regardless of how one feels about Brian Michael Bendis, that's still big news.
Yeah.
You know, he was the face of Marvel for at least a decent amount of time. But now it's, you know, there's so many writers write for on multiple platforms and for multiple publishers that you don't really have someone so intrinsically linked to one company or another that a move from one to the other is like a seismic sort of shift. And again, I'm not talking quality. I'm not talking, you know, how one feels about Bendis is writing here, there, or anywhere else is not the point. The point is, like, that was a big deal.
It was a big deal. I mean, but you're not going to get anything, like, on the level of, like, Kirby leaving Marvel. That was devastating to the comics world.
Yeah, and that was 40, 50, however many years ago.
But writers go back and forth.
Stanley doing a run of DC, you know, what ifs.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's a lot of announcements are kind of, there are things where you're like, oh, that's interesting. Oh, okay, well, I like that writer and they're taking over this particular title. Well, that's nice, but we probably saw that coming from them that way. You know, at some point, Jonathan Hickman's going to write Legion of Superheroes and we're all going to be like, well, that makes perfect sense.
I think he already is, but he's calling it X-Men.
Oh, right, yes.
Yeah. And real quick, before we move on from this, a listener contacted me on Twitter. Specifically, it's Marshall from the Journey Into podcast. Everyone should listen to that podcast. It's very good. And he was listening to one of our older episodes and pointed out that we had made a prediction that the Joker movie would never get made and never be released.
Yeah.
So this is just an example of a tradition that I personally have fallen for a long time, which is being wrong. So I hope we can keep that up in our next 50 episodes.
That's awesome that we did that.
Yeah. Well, you know, Joker was released, of course, and it's a game-changing, revelatory, new, dark take on comic books that has never been seen before, except for Logan, Batman v Superman, all the Nolan Batman films, Blade, Road to Perdition. Other than that, it's never, ever been done before.
The caveat is that neither of us have seen it yet.
No. And honestly, I have no desire to.
I'll see it eventually. It just
eventually it'll jump on Netflix and I'll see it there. But I'm not. I have limited time and money, and when I go to the movies, I want it to be something more than a Scorsese ripoff. I've actually seen Taxi Driver, and I've seen King of Comedy, and I've seen Network, so I'm good.
So there you go.
Now I'm sure it's fine. Everyone likes it. Apparently, it'll win all the Oscars because it's a real movie and it's cinema and all that. Do I sound cynical? Yeah, a little bit.
You sound cynical.
It's fine. I'm sure it's fine. Moving on.
And it's
enough
edgy.
Of that. Oh, I'm sure it's edgy. It's grimdark. But one thing that did come out of New York Comic Con was DC's plan for legacy characters, or at least it was clarified a bit more.
Yeah, I think it's less legacy. It's apparently there is a plan to replace Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Green Lantern, a bunch of their characters with, younger or different characters. Yeah. And we touched on this a little bit with Luke Fox taking over for Batman. Yes. But I don't think at the time that we knew or others knew that it was going to be quite so extensive. Like Jonathan Kent, what we think is the plan is that Jonathan Kent is going to age and take over for Clark Kent as Superman. Someone's going to replace Wonder Woman, the young green Teen Lantern from Young Justice is going to replace Hal Jordan as Green Lantern, because we've never had Green Lantern being replaced by anybody before.
Oh, no. There's going to be a new Flash. That's new.
It's always been Hal Jordan.
There's going to be a new Aqualad.
And in some cases, I think they're not doing legacy in terms of who you expect to take over for said characters. Yeah. It's going to be somebody a little out of the box.
But the other thing that Dan Didio elaborated on was that it's going to be split into generations. The storylines will be split into generations. So
the 5G.
Yeah. So generation one is defined by Wonder Woman becoming the first public superhero. That's new. I don't think that's ever been in continuity before, is it?
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah. The second generation starts with the appearance of Superman. The third generation spans from Crisis to Flashpoint. And the fourth generation is what we're reading right now.
Right.
So the fifth generation, or 5G, like you just mentioned, apparently will have really good Wi-Fi.
Mm-hmm.
And,
unavailable in most areas.
That's right. And this is where all the new legacy characters will come in. I'm not exactly sure how they intend to roll them all out. If you heard more about that, let me
know. Not really. I think it's everything's still kind of shadowy, and like there's supposed to be a big shakeup and creators and all of that is fine. And what I actually appreciate is that DC is showing a plan.
Yeah.
like an extended plan. I mean, one thing Marvel always had going for it was those writers' retreats that they would do, and they would do like their own little Bible of like an extended 1-3 year plan of, and then the writers would kind of stick to it, and there would be sort of a running theme in order to get to an endpoint, usually involving some kind of event that would change the face of the universe forever. Now, DC's guilty of the same thing, although they generally tend to try to do it less often.
Yeah.
Like, what? You know, it's everything. Like, they've at least managed to spread their crises out.
Yeah. Well, they, you know, just to speak to what you were just saying, they usually start with a plan. Like, Rebirth had a plan, and they were really, really good comics. And then that plan sort of just goes away. And it kind of randomly scatters into a million pieces, and they say, oh no, we have a crisis on our hands.
Right.
And then they bring it back.
DC's biggest problems is via editorial. They can't stick to a thing. And there's too much editorial fiddling, and things just go... You know, it's like like 1 year later, although these many years ago, that could have been a really interesting idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
It just
didn't go anywhere.
There was no coordination to it, and it fizzled and died.
Yeah. Oh, well, you're enjoying Doomsday Clock, but mm-hmm. I think
there's a bigger picture there, and I think
about that
on our Alan Moore episode.
Yeah, that was supposed to be a thing that a whole bunch of other comic storylines would hinge on. But because of its delays, all the other comics just moved on. Yeah, right. Yeah, we'll get back to that eventually.
Which you kind of have to at some point, because there's only so many stopgap stories that you can write.
Right. But that speaks to DC's, you know, lack of plan. Here, we got this really great idea. That's not going to happen. So, yeah, just go off and talk amongst yourselves.
I think they've done better. It's hard to blame DC completely for Doomsday Clock, where at the end of the day, it's you have to blame the creators.
Well, Geoff Johns got a new job, basically.
And right.
He doesn't have enough time to... I mean, I understand that. I'm not criticizing it.
Delayed, you know, and some of it may be Gary Frank, and I appreciate the fact... I love Gary Frank's art, and I think he's done a great job with Doomsday Clock in terms of... not specifically aping Gibbon's art, because why would he?
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, it's at the same time, it's like you want the artist to have all the time in the world to make the best possible visual representation. And if that means delays because of the artist, I am way less fussy about that than other people are. I would rather see Geoff John or Gary Frank as the only artist on Doomsday Clock, as opposed to bringing in
fillers and whatnot, right?
Fillers and what have you, because we've seen that over and over and over again, and it really visually is jarring. So, but I'm not sure how much. I doubt that this is on Gary Frank as much as on Geoff Johns. I don't know. I'm not in the room with. I'm not typing up the story.
Yeah. So. No, I mean, I don't blame Geoff Johns for not having the time to put into this, because he's doing other things. And I get that. At the same time, this was supposed to be, you know, a linchpin story where, you know, where all the other comics were going to spin off of it. And that has turned out not to be the case.
Right. And it may be, and this is part of the reason, rumor-wise, because that's what we do, rumors, sort of like a rumor that Joker will never get made, Hickman probably could have gotten Legion if it weren't for all the delays on Doomsday Clock. It makes me sad.
Yes, it is sad.
Sick.
But back to the legacy character things. Fan reaction to this has been surprisingly negative. A rare occurrence in today's comic book fandom.
I hear that.
Yes, let us now pause for comedic effect. No, I mean, I think from what I've been reading, it's kind of leaning towards the negative, but a lot of people are like you and me who just say, oh yeah, that sounds like a fine idea. Just
sounds interesting. Yeah. Let's wait and see.
Exactly. You know, we've talked about this on this show, ad infinitum. just let things happen. But the bottom line to me is that in this medium, this serialized storytelling, using characters that are 40, 50, 80 years old, they need to be experimented with and changed from time to time in order not to become stale.
Right.
You know,
and yeah. I think we're both on record, like you said, ad infinitum. And, you know, we're both on record as like, you know, change is good. Let's you know, shake yeah. things up. Yeah. You know, we've stated before, it doesn't have to be Bruce Wayne under the cowl. It really doesn't.
Yeah. But the fact, it comes down, you know, new ideas, new situations, new scenarios, whatever, need to be tried out to keep the medium vibrant. And, right. and inevitably, it's going to go back to status quo. Inevitably, there will be, you know, there will be a time when everybody has to have the original characters back in place again.
Unless something really sticks.
But even when they do that, there will now be a revived purpose and hopefully a new energy to that old material because you've tried yeah. new things.
I mean, the industry is, I don't want to say dying.
No, I don't think it's dying at all.
That's not fair. But the fans are. and why does Wonder Woman have to be Diana? We have a wealth of Diana stories that all the fussy folks can go back and read and reread and reread to their heart's content. You know what? Most of the people complaining aren't buying the monthly issues anyway. Yeah. They're not reading the current runs. They're just going back and rereading the stuff that gives them comfort and then getting on message boards and complaining about any change.
And that stuff
that they're not actively involved with anyway.
Yeah, that old stuff isn't going away. It's still there. You can, it's yours. You know, and it doesn't ruin anything for you. It's still there.
Those stories are never going away. I think the only caveat, and I get some of the complaints in that if it's done badly, if the transition is done badly and the sense is that the transition is being done just to transition, I kind of get the complaint there. And so the onus then is on editorial and the writers to make it a natural transition. You can, and this can be done. It can be a natural transition, but I think people get upset when they feel like it's just thrown in. It's literally the spaghetti on the wall.
Yeah, well, you know, if you look at something like the introduction of Wally West as the new Flash,
I was thinking about Wally West as well. Yeah,
yeah, he became the Flash for
and generation of people. Folks who grew right for many folks who grew up in a certain time period, Wally West will always be the Flash.
Yeah. And then you had the revivalist of Jeff Johns has to put it back to the status quo again.
Right. Bringing back
everybody likes the character that they first read.
And I love Barry Allen, and I love Barry Allen as the Flash. It's great, but some of that cheapened what I felt like was, you know, bringing back Barry Allen, even though it was during a crisis, bringing him back kind of cheapened Crisis on Infinite Earths, a storyline that may come up later on in our discussion.
it might. And I guess in the end, that's what this whole thing will come down to. There's going to be this new change and we're going to see some new stories and it's going to be, you know, different for a while, but it will all end with a Crisis on Infinite Flashpoints and we'll be
on Infinite Flashpoint.
Exactly. It'll all come back to the beginning again and we'll start this whole conversation over again. It's just new stories, people. It's new stories, it's new ideas. Just give it a shot. And if it's not good, it's not good.
Let people tell interesting new stories. I mean, again, to go back to Bendis, you know, the one thing, regardless of what one feels about his writing or whatever else, you know, what he does is he facilitates bringing in his like good writers. Mm-hmm. He's almost a better team assembler. I don't, that's not the, that sounds like kind of dumb.
Team assembler. That's what,
a team assembler.
That's what they said in the Avengers. Like someone get a team assembler.
But you know, I mean, my God, Matt Fraction is doing a hell of a job with the Jimmy Olsen.
Oh, my goodness, yes, that's good.
Yeah, and you've got, Greg Rucka back in the fold doing an incredible Lois Lane. You know,
Bendis, it's almost like he's bringing all the architects that he brought in for Marvel.
He brings in, someone should make him an editor, or not an editor. No, God, no. not an editor.
A manager of some sort.
Continuity police would lose their minds. with the chief creative, what Jeff Johns was doing.
I think that's kind of, his default role right now. That's where he's, whether it's in title or not, that's where he sort of is. That's what he's doing.
Because his Wonder comics are so much fun. And that's based on him bringing in interesting writers and artists and people and kind of allowing them to just have fun.
That makes for good comics.
I don't know. But yeah, so, let's hope DC does that.
Yeah. So there you go. Try new things. Change is scary, but let's boldly go.
I don't like change.
Speaking of change, let's change the subject. Take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about probably one of the most interesting comics.
Famous and infamous?
I was going to say not infamous, because, maybe it's infamous. No, it's interesting, and it's revered in many circles. Anyway, we're going to talk about Swamp Thing when we come back.
Yes, indeed.
The Swamp, more than merely a place. It is a churning, seething, bubbling bed of life of which you are a part. Once you were a man, a chemist named Ted Salas, until one little experiment went somewhat awry. And you changed. The serum that was to have made you a super soldier combined with the strange forces in the swamp to make you over into this, a shambling, mindless mockery of your former humanity. The macabre Man-Thing.
Man-Thing was created in the early 1970s to capitalize on the growing monster craze, but under writer Steve Gerber, it became something quite different. Experimental, surreal, and very, very weird. It was something I loved as a kid, but does it still hold up today, 4 decades after its initial publication? So join me, Paul Matthew Carr, as I attempt to make sense of this cult classic and analyze each issue, putting it in the context of the time it was written and comparing it to the standards of today. And maybe you, too, can come to love the world's second most famous swamp-based comic book character as much as I do. The Nexus of All Realities, a Man-Thing podcast, a twice-monthly dive into the bizarre. And we're back! Brian, this is your recommendation this week. Tell us all about it.
Okay, I shall. Swamp Thing was created by Len Wein and Bernie Wrightson, first appearing in 1971 in House of Secrets number 92. Ostensibly a generic horror trope character, Wein and Wrightson did decent but limited work with the character, with vague points to the existential nature of their creation. When noted appropriator Alan Moore took over the character, with the brilliant editor Karen Berger overseeing, in the early 80s, the character was transformed into a true avatar, not just of the green, but as a cipher between horror and the human condition. The concept of nature has always had a dark side. The theory of rot and rebirth, the creepy unknown under the soil, the horror of decay and the mystery of life, all life as cyclical and dependent. Even an undercurrent of sexuality festers within the unspoken secrets of the natural world. With Alan Moore's Swamp Thing run, we are exposed to all the taboos that have been kept hidden. Like an unfolding leaf in spring or the rotting smell of soil in autumn, Moore peels back that which we are most uncomfortable with and paints it on a canvas of deeply held terrors. In the arc that encapsulates the Murder of Crows collection, we are lulled into an expectation of horror comics with stories about ghosts, serial killers, drug frenzy, and strange sexual desire. But within the context, we see the seeds of a longer story, one in which the very nature of existence revolves around the question of where is evil? John Constantine, Moore's greatest creation, is ever present, urging our titular hero to awareness. And the Swamp Thing is often backgrounded, more a reaction than a protagonist or antagonist. A crisis occurs, and this is used not as a throwaway, but as a springboard to a deeper meditation on existence. Stan Walk, Stephen Bissett, John Tottleben, and Rick Veitch provide incredible stylized art along this journey, fully complementing the horror of Moore's stories in the grotesque, exaggerated, and manner the text demands. Seminal moments occur during this short example of a run, from the Parliament of Trees to a magical seance that will reverberate within the DC universe to this day. But is the overall picture caught in a few brief missives that Moore crafts. There is darkness under our feet and swaying in the wind above us, and the Swamp Things has only begun its journey inside. So, Paul, I recommended this. You read it and apparently did a lot of reading. Your thoughts on issues 43 through 50 of Swamp Thing that we are talking about in this particular conversation?
Okay, well, I'll talk about that in a second. First, I want to address noted appropriator.
Yes, Alan Moore, noted appropriator.
Great interpretation? Interpreter? No, appropriator. Okay. So, I guess we'll get into that. I was telling Brian a little bit beforehand that typically when we do an arc, my typical procedure is to read it for a couple of issues before the arc and a couple of issues after the arc, just to get a feel for the whole history of what I'm reading. And in this one, I started reading a few issues before and then got interested. So I read a few issues before that. And the next thing you know, I've read the entire Alan Moore saga of the Swamp Thing from beginning to end, because it's really good. And it actually does help to get this in the whole big picture of Alan Moore's ideas.
I mean, we'll try to
focus on just this arc, but he's throwing a lot of really big ideas out there. I mean, to me, this is a young, vibrant writer full of ideas and just letting loose on the page.
With a lot of freedom.
He has a lot of freedom, but he's still restrained. And he's still working within the conventions of his day. And I think has a lot to do with the editor that he's working with, who's giving him a lot of freedom, but at the same time saying, keep it in the idea of a story. Don't go crazy, Alan.
Well, there's a reason why Karen Berger is beloved as an editor.
Yeah. She's one of the best ever, but this was, this is Alan Moore, at his creative heights. The 80s Alan Moore is kind of my favorite. He will do other things in the future, and I'm not going to disparage those things at all, because he's one of the best in comics. I mean, when you talk about the pantheon of great comic book writers, Alan Moore is up there.
Yes.
But the stuff that I go back to and that I personally find the most entertaining is this 80s stuff, and especially Swamp Thing.
Right. And to me, I, commit the heresy of thinking that Swamp Thing is his greatest work. I absolutely love Watchmen, we're not here to discuss Watchmen.
Thank God.
We're not here to bury Watchmen. No.
We come to bury Watchmen, not to praise it.
But to me, Swamp Thing it's a long form story, and he's addressing. So Watchmen is often a story about comics, and Swamp Thing is a story about us, and it's a story about all that encapsulates life and living, and it's so broad, in its attempt, and yet succinctly broad, if that makes sense.
Succinctly broad. That was my favorite 80s band.
The hair
was great.
Whereas I think that the story that Alan Moore was telling with Swamp Thing is important to outside of the genre in many ways, whereas some of the other work that he does, where it's brilliant, Watchmen is brilliant, I'm not contesting that, is singularly focused. And with Swamp Thing, there are so many layers and so many stories and so many world. There's so much world building that it stands as, I think, one of the great runs, period, not just what we're talking about here, but in terms of how it approaches the world around us and what consciousness it brings to the being.
No, I understand. No, he's dealing with some really intense concepts. But you're right. There's a lot of concepts going on. It's the meaning of life as told through vegetation.
A walking plant.
But he's using Swamp Thing as a jumping off point to talk about these various ideas like of human nature. And from the darkest aspects to its best.
Right. A thing that is not human and only, you know, retains memory of being human.
Well, that in and of itself is a really interesting concept. He detached the character from its humanity. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think that's kind of one of the best things that Alan Moore does in this. The Swamp Thing was always a guy turned into a swamp creature.
Right.
Well, he detached it from that completely.
In and of itself, an interesting concept.
Yeah, and he detached it from that and made him an elemental being, a manifestation of life itself.
Well, and the avatar of the green, or all that, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, but by doing that, by making him this avatar of life, he's able to delve into the different aspects. Different things, how life can manifest itself, and in doing so, he lets himself get into some of the darker natures of the human soul, the human condition. Yeah, it's a really impressive feat that he did.
Yeah, and I think for our purposes, what is interesting is, and Paul and I talked about this. We talked about this beforehand, very briefly. We don't actually plan in advance what we're going to talk about.
Oh, no.
That's not obvious, but that's on purpose. So when I trades are interesting, like trade collections. And so, you know, and we deal sort of with what we consider to be like, as per our name, a collected edition. And so what is interesting is, so the trade that I picked was published in 2011. This is an old, there have been numerous reprints of Swamp Thing in various sizes and what have you, but this particular trade is from 2011. I think it was like, at the time, it was number 4 of the trade collections. I actually numbered them at the time, and you could keep track. And
it didn't start with a new number 1 every time? I don't understand that.
No, this is DC, not Marvel.
I get it.
Oh, and so the editorial or the collected decision made that it was these specific issues, issue 43 through 50, that whoever was putting together the trade at the time decided that thematically these 8 issues belong together. And I think that it is an interesting decision. So what we don't have is My Blue Heaven, which is many people consider the greatest Swamp Thing story. We don't have the initial introduction of John Constantine, which is in an earlier trade. And this trade is kind of designed, it goes up through issue 50, and issue 50 is a major issue in Swamp Thing. It was a time in which big issues like a 50 or a 25 or a 75 or what have you actually had import that were designed to carry forward into, you know, continuity, as opposed to just like, hey, it's an anniversary issue, let's have an artist jam. And, you know, we'll talk about like the legacy of the character, and no, because issue 50 actually has one of the most important scenes in DC Comics history that has certainly carried forth into and is still used to this day. And we're talking about the death of two specific characters that informs John Constantine's character in particular, but also the entire realm of magic within the DC universe, and is still referenced to this day. We could get into that later. But the way the structure, the way this is collected shows a structure that Alan Moore is working on that is quite fascinating. And I think the way that this was compiled sort of shows this, because the first three issues within this collection are ostensibly standalones. And they mirror what has been in Swamp Thing before, where there's a lot of, you know, we're going to tell a horror story, and then the Swamp Thing's going to show up within this horror story and react to said thing. But the story is actually more about not the Swamp Thing, but those who are within the story, and the Swamp Thing is almost peripheral.
Yeah. Well, with an added framing device, which is John Constantine is essentially sending them on these missions.
Right.
Say, go to this area, see what's going on here, see if you can fix this problem with the magical world. Which kind of sets him up for the big finale. Yeah.
So the first three issues of this are, we have literally a drug frenzy story, like drugsploitation, if you want to call it that. We have a serial killer story, and we have a ghost story.
A haunted house kind of a thing, yeah.
Right, a haunted house ghost story. And so they're very specific genres within the horror, the overarching horror world. And those stories are used to examine the human condition. Again, with Swamp Thing reacting or just showing up, like at the end, as a as a device, the first story, issue 43, is it's the tubers that are growing off of Swamp Thing.
Yeah, tubers, not tuber, no, tumors.
tubers. Yes. Well, are they tubers or are they
tuber or not tuber? That's the question. But no, I do like the fact that, because you one person eats the tuber and has a hallucinogenic experience, mm-hmm. and it's he's not a good person, so he sees only evil, and his internal badness is
it's elevated,
realized. Yeah, whereas the woman who eats it, who is a good person, she sees only beauty and light and hippie dreams,
right?
And I think she went to a dead show.
I'm pretty sure the main protagonist in the story, Chester the hippie, who finds the tuber and is investigating it, and then just randomly gives it to people because, hey, I found this thing in the swamp. Here, you want some?
If you're going to do experiments, you might as well, you know.
do them on people.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting story, and of course it ends with, so you have two different people who have consumed the Swamp Thing's tuber. there's a lot to unpack there that maybe we should just leave alone. But there is a lot to unpack there, and people can go deeper into this if they wish. But but each of these two people that consume this portion of the tuber that Chester the hippie finds, like out in the swamp, not only are they having their hallucinations based on, you know, the psychedelic or the psychotropic aspects, they, both of these hallucinations are part of the Swamp Thing's, Alec Holland's, particularly Alan Holland's psyche, as opposed to the Swamp Thing's psyche. So he's shedding memory.
Is that okay?
Well, because it's like the bad guy is like, he's seeing everything, like all of his hallucinations are based on, there's this whole bit about like he can't tell if he's Alec Holland or if he's himself. Right. It references like the origin of Alec Holland and the Swamp Thing. He can't tell if he's himself or if he's Alec Holland experiencing the moment in which he is killed.
Well, it's a sense he's merging with. It's the same thing he does when he has, you know, sex.
Right.
Where two people kind of become one and they share each other's thoughts and memories. Now, when the bad guy, the drug addict, takes this in, he can't handle this merging of the two minds.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So he reacts poorly.
Oh, no. I was just going to say, Alec Holland's consciousness is present in the hallucinations.
Right.
And of course, the story ends with Chester the hippie. Like, he gets the, you know, people come back to him and relate the two specific reactions. And Chester, who considers himself to be a good person, and he has internal monologue of, you know, should he eat part of this, what's left of this tuber? And he's like, well, I'm a good person. It should affect me positively. But then he has questions.
Yeah. He has done bad things.
He's like, you know, he's like, I eat meat. You know, and it's like, well.
Yeah. Well, he also sells drugs. So sells or drugs. Has sold drugs. So.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and he thinks he starts thinking about, like, have I done good? Am I good or am I bad? And those are, I'm using those generic phrases on purpose. And of course he opts. So he's about to eat it thinking he's okay. And then he decides not to, because he doesn't know.
If you have well, that's a thing. That's a very theological type of thing. If you believe yourself to be evil, you will be evil. It's a very Eastern thought, actually.
Right. And dare you eat the fruit from the Garden of Eden?
Right. Will you be cast out of Eden, or will you be embraced by heaven? Yeah. Like we said, there's a lot of really interesting ideas that are going on here.
And they play into, like, this is a standalone story, except it certainly thematically plays into what happens later on, like a few issues later.
Oh, yeah. There's definitely an arc. Everything that happens here is standalone, like you said, but there is a connective theme that runs through all of these stories. Kind of like a vine.
Yes.
That entangles everything. So he's learning. And, you know, and that's where that framing device of Constantine sending him on these missions. Mm-hmm. You have to learn how to beat the big bad at the end of the season. How we think of television shows and how television is structured these days is very much going on here in, what was this, 1983?
Yeah, 85.
Yeah, that's not what was happening in television back then. Mm-hmm. But if we look at how, you know, there's standalone episodes where the characters learn things and then they have a big confrontation with the big bad at the end. That's exactly how this arc is structured.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really impressive, actually.
And it continues on in the next two sort of semi-standalone issues. Now, things are happening within these issues. There are, you know, typical... There are, you know, we switch away from the main action to various things going on behind the scenes, whether it be with Abby Cable or Constantine himself or what have you. But, you know, the next two, you have, you know, the Swamp Thing, you have the bogeyman, or what, basically a serial killer who thinks of himself as a bogeyman. And the story is all about a lot of internal monologue about, you know, why he kills, and he keeps track of the numbers and what have you. And again, the Swamp Thing shows up at the end.
Yeah.
And basically takes out the bogeyman. Now, the Swamp Thing kills.
Oh, yeah.
Swamp, you know, this isn't your typical, you know, this ain't Superman or Batman, you know, who don't kill. You know, this the Swamp Thing identifies an evil and takes it out.
Yeah, this is the same way he would, you know, pull a weed or remove rot. That's what he sees evil and he's going to take it out. He's a gardener.
Because it's in between the human and the supernatural, or the human and the natural. Not that humans aren't natural, but, you know, nature tends to itself, as it were. And then the third story leading into, like, after all this, of course, is the ghost story, of the Haunted Mansion story, which has a slight heavy-handedness to it, because it's a message. There's like an overt message involving violence and guns in particular. and references the famous Winchester house.
Well, it's a kind of a play on the Winchester house, because I don't think it actually is the Winchester. It's not specifically.
No, they're calling it something else. It's the Cambridge house. Names were changed to protect the innocent.
The innocent, exactly.
Or the lawsuit prone.
That's right. Do you want us to get sued? Change that name. Of the three stories, I kind of think this is the weakest.
The third, yeah, same here.
Yeah, because you have it ends on a really weird note, where the woman is having an affair, but her husband is it, I think it's her husband, correct?
Yeah,
and he's sort of become subservient at the end. I don't know. It was a weird ending.
Yeah, it's essentially so. The story revolves around the ghosts are all the victims of a particular gun that was manufactured. Now it's not even really subtle in suggesting it's the Winchester rifle, although here they're calling it the Cambridge rifle, right. So it's this haunted house where that one of the, if folks aren't familiar with the Winchester house, it's a relative of the manufacturer of a particular type of weapon. It has a guilty conscience about the fortune that they have based on this weapon that they perceive to be responsible for a lot of innocent death and what have you. And so the Winchester house was is a real thing, which was created that is a completely nonsensical, takes up like 50 acres someone can fact check us on this, but the idea is that the hammers had to keep pounding to keep the ghosts at bay.
Yeah, so they had to keep building and building and building, and a lot of staircases. This is actually a real place, too.
Yes, it is, yeah.
So staircases just run into walls, and there are doors leading to nothing. Rooms that are completely walled off. Yeah, it's a bizarre thing to have.
Secret passageways.
Yes, it's very strange, and it has a kind of a sinister overtone to it. So, of course, Alan Moore was going to incorporate it into his mythology. Because that's what he does. He appropriates.
He does appropriate. It's certainly the most overtly political. Like, by political, I mean, like, overtly. It's certainly the least gray area of his writing in The Swamp, or at least in this particular arc that we're talking about. It's the one where the writer Alan Moore is more a part of the story than he is in some of the previous and subsequent pieces.
Yeah, well, there are times when his voice comes out very loud and clear. He has his likes and dislikes, and you will know about it.
Yes.
Yeah. One of which is he's not fond of guns.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
But again, all three of these, like, there are things that happen in each of these issues that come back into play in the subsequent five issues that I think are, like, the more important. Important is maybe not the right word, but the next five issues are the ones where things start to coalesce.
Yeah, so he's going, you know, I was about to say Man-Thing. Swamp Thing. So Swamp Thing, he's going to get to the main story. But the previous three storylines are necessary for him to come to the resolution that eventually happens. Yeah, so they're needed in this story.
But I think what's interesting is that what follows, following these three issues, is the Crisis on Infinite Earths crossover. Company mandated Crisis on Infinite Earths crossover. Everybody had to have one. Or more. oftentimes, those crossover issues with big events, and we hadn't really, people forget, like with Crisis, the first Crisis, this concept of a company-wide crossover was a new idea.
Yeah, this was just something that was just starting to be the norm in comics.
And so a lot of writers get stymied in those, and a lot of times those issues become kind of toss-off issues, you know, and oh, I have to write this. I get 12 issues of, a year. I get 11 where I get to tell my story, and one of them I had to tell somebody else's story, and I'm just going to write whatever. So, but Alan Moore instead uses this as a complete springboard into the story that he wants to tell.
Yeah, it's almost as if he had the story he wanted to tell, and they told him, oh, you have to do a crisis. All right, fine. So he incorporated the crisis into his story rather than the other way around.
Yes. And it's so well done.
It really is. And the thing about having the crisis is there are certain magical characters in the DC universe that suddenly become available because of this crisis that he is allowed, that suddenly are allowed to be incorporated into this greater story.
And he uses them all to full effect.
Yes, absolutely.
It's almost like they open up the sandbox even more for him to play with.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes, I agree. And he uses them in very unique and interesting ways. I've never been a huge fan of Deadman, but he's used to fantastic effect in this story.
Oh, yeah. And I think, this issue, it's the fourth issue that we're, the crisis crossover, it's called Revelations. And what is interesting is throughout that entire issue, the crisis is dismissed by everybody that is speaking. It's still ongoing in the main comic. And everybody within this issue, they're just like, oh, this will pass. This is a multiverse. It's not a, you know, specific to this Earth. So they're basically setting up a result that's still to come in the limited series. They're basically tossing out this Earth is fine. Everybody's like, this Earth is fine. You know, they're folding in the multiverse, and there's a scene where Swamp Thing has to go up to Alex Luthor's little satellite, and everybody's there, including Ambush Bug. Which was a nice little cameo. There's another cameo coming up that I hope you caught, Paul. But we'll get to that with the Parliament of the Trees.
Yes.
Okay. But it's Constantine being Constantine and moving further away from being just Sting. And
yes, because he was based on Sting.
But so the whole setup with this is basically it leads to the idea that everything's going to be fine. The Earth is going to survive. The multiverse is collapsing, but all these things are just going to happen. And, you know, but what this is, what has been done is then the supernatural world has been reawakened.
Yes. And one of the things that I kind of enjoyed is all the magical characters, the characters who deal with the supernatural, they're seeing this crisis and they're going, yeah. You know, we've all been to hell. It's fine. This is going to be okay.
Yeah.
This is really meaningless to us. We're going to move on.
Yeah. Moore just completely throws out like all the concern for melding of all the worlds because he's more concerned with what happens in the supernatural world, in the unseen world, as opposed to, you know, the big white thing coming and wiping out all of
exactly
in the people.
I did like that, you know, you were exactly right how he used it as a springboard. Okay, let's just get past this. But along the way, I'm going to be able to pick up a bunch of characters that I probably wasn't going to use before, but now he used it to a great effect.
Yeah.
I wish that everyone in crossovers could do that. Because typically what you see today is that, you know, this whole storyline just has to stop. We do our crossover and then it'll pick up later. It folds it
into the plot that he was already going with.
Exactly.
Well, that plot is ultimately that. So there is a group of male witches called the Brugeria.
Sure. Let's go with that.
Sure.
I was waiting for you to pronounce it and I'll just run along by.
Right. So this is leading to sort of into one of Moore's biggest stories. And it is the idea that there are a group of really horrible individuals who are planning on unleashing, using this crisis as an opportunity to unleash
hell on earth.
This hidden horror that has been held back in the periphery of time and space and what have you, not to take over the earth, but to take over heaven.
Yeah, or is it to destroy heaven?
To destroy heaven.
Yeah, yeah.
So we go right from a crisis on earth to a crisis in the heavens.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. And then in the course of doing this, he then expands his own mythology, the Swamp Thing mythology, to incorporate other elemental beings previous to him. So right. He's just one in a long lineage of swamp-based or vegetation-based elemental creatures.
And that's where we run into the Parliament of Trees.
The Parliament of Trees, which is a really great idea.
Yes.
Which is all previous incarnations of the Green that have rooted themselves, have completed their mission, and are now just becoming trees.
Right.
Yeah.
They're sleeping, a long slumber in some cases. But it's basically, yes, every avatar of the Green has, you know, Constantine talks to. And this issue is actually an interlude. This is after the Crisis crossover. And then we have what I consider to basically be an interlude before the super action begins going forward. And it is the introduction of Swamp Thing to all of those that have come before.
He sort of gets there. He gets a little bit of history. And he gets to, you know, gets imparted some cryptic wisdom.
And you see, like, you know, that visually you are presented with a lot of the avatars of the Green, including, I believe, Man-Thing.
Yes, you get a little, just in one panel, you get a little shot of just an eye and a little, you know, face tendrils. That's definitely Man-Thing.
It's clearly Man-Thing. Even though you only get half the face, it's Man-Thing.
without a doubt. And, you know, I like that little tip of the hat, my fellow swamp-based creature.
And I had forgotten about that. So when I was rereading that, I was like looking at it going, hey, that's Man-Thing. And there's also Alan Moore himself makes a cameo in a panel in a couple issues prior to that. But that's not as important. But so for folks who may not be aware, Paul is a Man-Thing fan.
I should put some context behind that. I do another podcast called The Nexus of All Realities, which is about the character of Man-Thing from Marvel Comics. So, I did appreciate seeing him there. I had forgotten that as well. And I got to that panel and just said, oh, look who's here. A main man, Manny. You know, it should be stated, just as an aside, Man-Thing and Swamp Thing, although on the surface very similar, are completely different characters, and their stories are telling totally different directions. Any coincidence or any similarity between the two is purely superficial.
Yes just and no, though. I mean, but they're two faces of a similar coin.
Well, Man-Thing is a cipher. Things happen around him. He doesn't have a personality of his own. He allows other stories to flourish around him. Whereas Swamp Thing is integral to his stories. He has a personality. He has an intelligence.
Right. But in the stories leading up to this, Man-Thing is or Swamp Thing is actually almost a cipher. In the penultimate issue of this collection, he's barely there.
Well, no, he's allowing. Oh, that we'll get to that.
Right. Well, yeah. We're interestingly enough, we're actually working our way through the story.
I know that's rare for us. We're not jumping all over the place. So he meets the Parliament of Trees.
Right, and I think that besides the fact that the introduction of the Parliament of Trees is very seminal. It also then it gives poor Alec Holland / Swamp Thing. It sends him further into this sort of it makes him even more lost philosophically in terms of his purpose. And, you know, of course, you know, the there are various things, but Swamp Thing asks questions of the Parliament of Trees, and they are very dismissive of him because he's young. He's a child in their eyes. And, yes, of course, we get the great line, you know, where is evil in all the wood?
Right. And so, yeah.
And then they reject him, or he thinks they're rejecting him. They cast him out because he doesn't belong there yet. So they're not really rejecting him, although his perception is that he's been rejected by the Parliament, whereas in actuality, they're like, this is not where you should be right now. Your purpose and responsibility are elsewhere. You know, you can come back later, but
yeah, they're imparting some wisdom on him right now, and he's just not open enough to grasp what they're talking about.
Right.
But it will be important later on in the story. Yes. So then comes some really fine storytelling.
Right. And this is where, like, the philosophy drops away a little bit, and it really is just comics.
Yeah.
And I mean that in a good way. It's a defined series of actions and consequences and whatnot. Which is very interesting how Moore is able to, like, flip between the two with very great ease.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's some really fine visual storytelling that goes on in the next few issues. Just really incredible stuff. In fact, there's one panel sequence where it starts out with an open sky, and you see crows kind of flying towards you. And as they get closer and closer, their bodies block out so that the panels become all black, which is then followed by Constantine lighting a cigarette, which then...
Or attempting to.
And it's just, you know, it's so well done. This is just some really great art and some great visual storytelling.
And if go ahead.
No, go, if you could.
I could interject while you're talking about the visual storytelling aspect. Kudos to Stan Walk, Stephen Bissett, John Tuttleben, and Rick Veitch, all of whom, the transition between their art is seamless.
Yes, yes.
I mean, they work really well together. There are enough subtle differences. They each have their style, but they each work so well in the horror genre and in the creation of the visual aspect of this. It you know, I mean, they switch artists back and forth. I mean, this is a perfect example of where I was complaining earlier in the podcast about, you know, you can't replace Gary Frank on Doomsday Clock or what have you. This is one of those situations where these four artists in particular are able to transition around each other in an incredible way, and each bringing something unique, but still retaining that gloom and horror feel.
Oh yeah. They work incredibly well together. And there's just little things like every time Swamp Thing grows into a different environment, it reflects the plants that are, you know, he's not the same creature in the swamps of Louisiana as he is in the rainforest.
Right.
Of Brazil.
The Tefe at the banks of the Tefe.
Just so little stuff like that, little details are really just amazing. And then just the creepiness of it all. There's a lot of body horror. And yeah, it's just this whole aesthetic to the comic is just great.
So as an aside, because we had to give a shout out to the artist, but what happens over the next issue or so is it tells a straight story of Constantine and some of his cohorts along with the Swamp Thing trying to invade the caves where the Brugera are in the process of working towards bringing about, you know, the destruction of heaven, bringing this unnamed horror from beyond space and time. And there's betrayal. There are action sequences. There is a woman who is converted from a human to a crow. And the crow, of course, is important, and hence the murder of crows. Where she is then to be the messenger that takes this pearl of knowledge or what have you to the ends of existence. And Swamp Thing makes a mistake where he saves the wrong, he saves Constantine as opposed to stopping this messenger of doom, this crow.
Or does he?
Well, there's the question, who is more, you know, without Constantine, what happens later can't happen.
Exactly. So everything needed to play out exactly the way it did. That transformation of the woman into the crow is really just gruesome.
Yes, it's horrifying. It's absolutely horrifying.
And you see how they told her she'll be able to fly.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't lie to her, but they didn't tell her the whole truth.
No, they sure didn't.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a gruesome sequence, but still very cool in that horrific art style. There is a little subplot going on about Abby Cable being arrested for interspecies relationships,
which is interesting. But it's all like kind of that's all backgrounded.
Yeah, and well, you know, in typical fashion.
That comes into play in subsequent issues that not covered here.
Yeah, in the next arc. But just, you know, just to say, like, in typical fashion of comics at this time, there are subplots going on that won't be paid off for sometimes years down the line.
Right.
But that's going on in this story.
Ultimately, what we're leading towards is the last couple issues, which... next to the last issue in our arc, 49 is the summoning, and it's basically a like it's a Kurosawa moment.
Yes,
or it's a Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney moment. It's like world's gonna end. Let's put on a show, and it's essentially working their way into bringing in all of these sort of magical figures. And the Swamp Thing is barely a presence in a lot of this. It's Constantine, who is the main character in particularly issue 49, where, you know, we bring in the specter, you know, so they basically go in search of help from all of the sort of magical or supernatural characters within the DC universe. And we get the Phantom Stranger shows up again. We get the Spectre. We get Dr. Fate, Dr. Occult, Baron Winter, Sargon the Sorcerer. We get Zatara and Zatanna. And you know, it's basically a quest to, you know, bring in the warriors from across the land to defend the city.
Yeah, I love the way Constantine gets everyone on board. It's like, oh, you don't want to join? Well, Sargon said he would do it. I'll just go to him. Oh, well, Sargon's going to do it. I'll do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, then he goes to Sargon and say, well, you know, Baron Winter was going to do it.
Well, so-and-so's going to do it. I'll do it.
So he's just seen the manipulating little bastard he can be.
And we also are, we have Steve Dayton brought back in, who was Mento, who was, of course, originally with the Doom Patrol and is emotionally and mentally fragile to begin with. And therein lies the biggest tragedy of the story, is leading into the final issue, which is the big confrontation between the forces of light and the forces of darkness, and you know, the age-old story of
well, this I do like this twist where, you know, the forces of hell and the forces of heaven kind of come together.
We even have the angels like or what is representative of angels.
Exactly. Yeah, so I do like all the magical beings come together in one big last stand against the darkness. And it is this, and the evil is this formless void.
And but formless is accurate, because we have the evil, this formless void is trying to learn. It's a child, essentially. And so you have various instances where some of the magical characters in the DC universe are absorbed into the void and are questioned about what is the nature of this, what is your nature, who are you, what do you represent? And none of the characters, including the Spectre, can properly answer the question to this void in a way that's satisfying. Instead, the void is learning, you know, it's you know, from From Erdogan, it learns, you know, fatalism. From Fate, it learns contempt. From the Spectre, it learns vengeance.
Right. And they're all coming at this existential horror in the wrong way. They're bringing their own prejudices to this threat, thinking that they'll, you know, my strength is what's going to defeat it.
Right.
And that same arrogance is what defeats them.
Mm-hmm.
But you say the Swamp Thing's just sort of on the sidelines. But
this is where he becomes important. And right. All of what Alan Moore has set up with his meeting with the Parliament of the Trees and all of these things, this is where things change, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Where he learns to kind of embrace everything.
Yeah.
The good and evil, the light and the dark. And that's what he imparts to this formless void, evil child void.
Ultimately, the Swamp Thing then enters on his own free will and walks in with basically resignation.
Right. And yeah.
Like where the other characters enter the void with opinions, shall we say.
Or defiance.
Swamp Thing walks in and says, and is basically like, I have as many questions as you have, bro.
Yeah. And allow yourself to be part of, you know, the whole, part of the whole, rather than just a tiny piece of the greater world.
And he presents to this void what the Parliament of Trees were trying to teach him, you know, and the idea of like, where is evil in all the wood?
Which is nowhere. It is what you bring to it.
Right.
Yeah. It's just an incredible complex philosophy to be bringing to a Swamp Monster comic.
Right.
Alan Moore has some great ideas. I mean, there's a reason he has the reputation that he has, because he's bringing a lot of ideas to a medium that was lacking it. And at this time in the early 80s and onward, you know, this was the second British invasion, the comic book British invasion, however you want to phrase it.
Mm-hmm.
And you were getting other people like Grant Morrison coming in and Neil Gaiman and Warren Ellis eventually and others. They were all coming in at this time. Yes, absolutely. I'm leaving a lot of people off that list. But you know, this new infusion of ideas, because British comics were doing this sort of thing. They weren't constrained in the same way that American comics were by the Comic Code Authority or just the industry in and of itself. So these new writers were coming in and bringing, you know, complex ideas. Alan Moore kind of led that charge.
Certainly did, particularly with this. And I think it should be, you know, we've kind of reached the end of the story. The brief summation is that the conflict ends with heaven reaching down and the nameless, faceless, horrific void reaching up. And, you know, of course, it's a very famous, it references, a very famous painting.
Yeah, it's the Sistine Chapel.
Yeah. And then they merge.
Yes,
and become something different. And again, it's that and it's because of the Swamp Thing introducing this idea of the cyclical nature of life. It basically is, it's the cyclical. There is no evil because when one thing is killed, it feeds into another thing that feeds into another. Right. I mean, we all know what that's about. And then so the idea is that then everything is different. And the nature of life has changed, fundamentally changed.
Yes, it's still, you know, there's still going to be problems and there's still going to be challenges to be overcome. But there is now an integration of light and dark, which is, if you wanted a moral to a story, that's not a bad one.
And I think just as an aside, if we could talk about it, but we have to mention the scene. So Constantine, during all of this, Constantine has gathered all of these magic users together in like sort of a a cabal or what's the word I'm looking for?
A seance.
A seance. They've all joined hands and they're sending their power and their magics out to help the forces of good to fight this particular void. This is throughout all this. And as this is happening, we're beginning to realize who Constantine is as well. And Constantine is willing to sacrifice people.
And yeah, he's very pragmatic, and we get that. So we learned that.
The famous scene here is so both Sargon the Sorcerer and Zatara, possibly even more importantly, are killed during this. Mm-hmm. They burn up. And also Steve Dayton, Bento, who Constantine is using as the conduit for all of this because he has mental powers. Constantine knows that Steve Dayton, that his brain will be fried by this. And his brain is fried by this. And Constantine knew it was going to happen and used him anyway. And so we get the beginnings here of the character of John Constantine as well. And this scene in particular is referenced constantly. Zatanna becomes Zatanna because of what happens to her father, Zatara, in this. And this is maybe, this particular part of the story is maybe one of the most used and referenced parts of this entire story arc, like going forward in mm-hmm. DC Comics, like to this day.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's something that could have just been a throwaway thing is now integrated into the... So many people have picked up on this storyline.
It's canon in the magical, in the world of magic in DC Comics now.
And an integral part of Constantine's development, as you said. So, I guess we should say, this is good?
I mean, I think, so clearly we're going long at this point.
Yeah.
And I for our 50th, this is the level that which Swamp Thing, the comic, Alan Moore's run on the comic. Again, there were a million arcs I could have picked. And I had to decide on one. So I went with, let's go with Parliament of the Trees.
Right. Yeah.
And also, I think that this is the middle period of Alan Moore's run, and I think this is where he switches gears from one idea. He takes, this is where what he's working towards starts to really gel and starts to become something even deeper than what we had already been reading from him. And I think that this is the pivotal, these are the pivotal issues for Swamp Thing.
Yeah,
does that make sense? Do you agree? You went back and reread all this. Do you agree with that, or am I off base here?
No, absolutely. He spends the first, the first few issues just kind of establishing where he wants to go with the character. Once he decides that it's not Alec Holland anymore, Swamp Thing is just the Swamp Thing that has these kind of imprinted memories. He's a magical creature,
right?
An elemental creature. That's when he says, okay, now I got it. And then he's able to incorporate all of his philosophies, all of his ideas, different genres, different types of storytelling. He's introducing new characters like Constantine. And yeah, that's when this is it. This is when he just really starts to take off and he knows where he's going with this character.
And it's a hell of a ride.
It really is. This is a writer at the peak of his, not peak, but he really knows what he wants to do. Mm-hmm. And it's impressive to see.
And he's got another little comic coming up that probably is in his mind at this moment as well.
Yeah. So he's so we better watch, man.
Oh.
Okay. So that was a good one to have for 50.
Yeah.
I like
this. This is our big 50, and we could do a bonus edition down the line where we talk another couple hours on all the underlying themes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There can be and are other Swamp Thing podcasts out there.
Who wants to listen to, but I think as an overview and as a,
We're obviously both fans of this.
Right. Podcast. I think we would certainly, I bet a lot of folks out there, who are listening have their own sort of unique takes on the Swamp Thing, the entire run by Alan Moore, but mm-hmm. you know, perhaps this particular set of issues as well, that you know, we would certainly welcome additional commentary, because I think I'm sure there's stuff. There's stuff we didn't cover, but I'm sure there's stuff that maybe I didn't even think of. Maybe you didn't even think of the little things that have been seen in this. And I think that's why this series is so great and so important, is because of all the nuances that can be missed that somebody else catches on.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said about this. And as always, we want your feedback and and to hear what other people are thinking, and tell us what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong. You can always do that. We encourage it.
Talk to us.
Yes.
I believe we have another show coming up, the big 51.
Yes, 51, which will come out on Halloween, I believe. If I get my stuff together in time. And for Halloween, I have decided that we are going to read The Living Mummy. Now, this is it was actually part of an anthology in supernatural thrillers back in the 70s. It was written by Steve Gerber with art by Rich Buckler. It's only, the first story came out in issue 5 of Supernatural Thrillers and ran for 10 issues, I believe. If I'm wrong, I will clarify that on the next issue. But it's one of those... It's at the time when Marvel was, you know, allowed to do horror comics again. And so they did a Dracula comic. They did a werewolf comic. They did a Frankenstein comic. And then they
right up your alley.
Yes. And then they did a mummy comic. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to read Living Mummy next time for Halloween.
All right.
Hooray. Let's wrap this up. It's a mummy. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Of course, as we said, we'd love your feedback. So go to, sort of send us an email to comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or hit me up on Twitter. That's probably the best way to do it. That's where I talk to most people. So Collected Ed Pod, that's Collected ED Pod on Twitter, or go to our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, and you can leave comments on individual episodes. Anything else, Brian?
I've got nothing else.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening, and keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter @collectededpod. That's Collected, EDPOD. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained?